Law and Grace, Chapter 9, Part C, The Purification of the Leper and the Law of Jealousies. Priest and Nazarite alike stood for Israel. All the ceremonial attaching to them was intended for Israel's guidance and instruction, and at every turn made plain to all that holiness to the Lord was the moral corollary of membership of the priestly people. Thus, priest and Nazarite together showed the pious Israelite both what he was in status and also what he was meant to be in fact. But as a foil to them stood the leper, the type of the Israelite as seen not in his ideal, but in his actual state. The Israelite viewed as the victim of sin and its effect. Thus, as the priest was a parallel type to the sanctuary, so the leper was a parallel type to Egypt and its bondage, and the ritual accompanying his cleansing, a restatement of the lessons of Passover and Exodus in more detailed form. We have already studied the leper as a type of the universal sinner. All that remains for us now is to abstract from the ritual of his cleansing the great spiritual lessons which it was intended to convey. The significance of the leper's exclusion from the camp we have already seen. It typified that separation which sin causes between God and man, and did so in such telling fashion precisely because the man's disease was so palpably apt a symbol of sin and the death to which sin leads. The leper in whom the plague is, his clothes shall be rent and his head bare, and he shall put a covering upon his upper lip and shall cry, unclean, unclean. He was, as it were, a mourner in advance at his own funeral, a kind of living corpse, bemoaning its own demise. He thus stood in sharp contrast to both priest and Nazarite, being permanently defiled by death, even while still alive, unless he happened to recover from his dread disease. All the days wherein the plague shall be in him, he shall be defiled, he is unclean, he shall dwell alone, without the camp shall his habitation be. He is unclean, said the law. That is, his malady technically put him in the category of those not in covenant with God. Upon his cure, therefore, he had first to be reinstated as a full member of the covenant people, and the law devised a special ritual ordinance to make this possible. First, the priest, a type of God here, of course, examined him outside the camp, and confirming that his plague was really healed, gave authority for the ritual to be followed, which would enable him to be pronounced clean. That is, once more, in covenant with God as he had been before he fell victim to the plague. Then shall the priest command to take for him, that is to be cleansed, two birds, alive and clean, and cedar and scarlet and hyssop. As was fitting, the birds had to be clean, since they were meant to typify one who was a member of God's people, but one bird could not serve as a symbol of him both as he had been, a dead man, and as he had now become, virtually a man alive from the dead. Two birds were therefore necessary, the one to typify him as when he was in the grip of his uncleanness, the other to typify him in his new state of recovery from that uncleanness. It would, however, have ruined the whole effect of the ritual if one of the birds brought had been dead already. This would indeed have most effectively symbolized the wretched condition of the man while still the victim of his leprosy. But it could not, on the other hand, have served to bring out the basic lesson of the ritual that the effects of sin can only be undone on the basis of full expiation. So the law was explicit: two birds, alive and clean. The first bird was killed on the priest's orders in an earthen vessel over running water. The earthen dish provided the nexus between the ritual and the man for whose benefit it was being conducted. He himself was but an earthen vessel of a different sort. The fresh water placed in it, drawn as it was from a running stream, spoke of life and cleansing. The next events were for this reason of great significance, since they spoke of the means by which cleansing came. As for the living bird, he shall take it, and the cedarwood, and the scarlet, and the hyssop, and shall dip them and the living bird in the blood of the bird that was killed over the running water. And he shall sprinkle upon him that is to be cleansed from the leprosy seven times, and shall pronounce him clean, and shall let the living bird loose into the open field. Before the second bird was released, it was dipped into the blood of the other, it and the other being thereby ritually declared to be really one bird, not two. Not only the bird, but the cedar wood, the scarlet, and the hyssop were likewise dipped into the blood with it. And lastly, the cleansed leper himself was sprinkled with the blood seven times. Cedar wood, being so durable, spoke of freedom from corruption. The scarlet dye, used commonly as a medicine, spoke of healing. The hyssop, used in connection with purification rites, both by the law and by the nations of the day, spoke in turn of purification. Yet, all three symbols, we note, only assumed their significance by virtue of being dipped in the dead bird's blood. This means that the blood had an atoning power, and that it was only on the basis of expiation that the stricken man, that is ultimately each individual sinner, could be cleansed and purified from his corrupting malady, that is ultimately from sin, of which the leprosy was but a type. To make the lesson plain, the leper was then himself sprinkled with the blood, and this seven times, since it spoke of the restoration of his covenant status. Thereupon the priest pronounced him clean, and thus at once qualified to resume his place in the camp. He could, as it were, rejoin his fellow Israelites. In token of the fact, the living bird was forthwith released so that it could, for its own part, rejoin the rest of its species from which it had been taken captive, in exactly the same way as the recovered leper whom it typified. Before he proceeded back into the camp, the leper had to give ritual assent to the fact that sinlessness was the basic requirement of residence within the camp. He that is to be cleansed shall wash his clothes and shave off all his hair and wash himself in water that he may be clean, and after that he shall come into the camp. The restored leper was beginning life afresh, and was thus like one newborn. So, though he was allowed in the camp, he still could not yet return to his tent. The law was, he shall tarry abroad out of his tent 7 days. On the last of these 7 days, he had again to shave himself bare, even his eyebrows, and carefully wash both himself and his clothes so that he could the better typify a newborn child. came the eighth day. To circumcise him afresh was impossible in the nature of things. So instead he had to acknowledge that his long absence from the camp had robbed a god of his service as one of the covenant people. On the eighth day, he shall take two lambs, two he lambs without blemish, and one ewe lamb of the first year without blemish, and 3/10 deals of fine flour for a meat offering, mingled with oil, and 1 log of oil. To help maintain the notion that the leper was but a helpless babe, newborn, the officiating priest acted throughout on his behalf. He presented and killed the offerings for him. The priest shall take one he lamb and offer him for a trespass offering and the log of oil and wave them for a wave offering before the Lord. Thus trespass offering came properly first, in recognition of the loss occasioned to God by the man's long absence from the sanctuary. It was its blood with the oil which made possible his consecration afresh as a member of the priestly people, hence the waving of Numbers 8, the waving of the Levites. The trespass offering was in effect his consecration offering, as the peace offering was in the case of Aaron and his sons. With its blood, the priest consecrated his ear, hand, and foot in token of the fact that consecration could not be effected except on the basis of atoning sacrifice. So next, and only next, the priest put some of the log of oil into his own left hand and sprinkled it 7 times before the Lord with one of his right fingers, and then put some of it upon the blood of the man's ear, tip, thumb, and great toe. He was now fully restored as a member of the priestly people, and in token of the fact, the law ordered that the remnant of the oil that was in the priest's hand he shall pour upon the head of him that is to be cleansed, and the priest shall make an atonement for him before the Lord. Thus the man who began as a foil to Aaron ended as one to Eliah, who to a large extent was a parallel type to him. His sin offering was next offered, and then his burnt offering and meal offering. Speaking of sin forgiven and of renewed surrender by the man of himself and his labors to his God, who had so graciously forgiven him. For the poor man, 1/10 of fine flour was allowed instead of 3, the 2 birds permitted to serve as substitutes for the he lamb of burnt offering and the ewe lamb of sin offering. But it had still, even in the case of a poor man, to be a he lamb for the trespass offering. The law, while making every concession to human infirmity and poverty, did not and could not sanction the slightest abatement of God's rights and claims. It would have men know how grave an affront was every human sin to the homeliness and sovereignty of Israel's God. In the case of the leprous house, there was, of course, no room for the ritual, which in the case of a man was essential to the restoration of his right to approach the sanctuary. This bore witness to the basic lesson that expiation was the prerequisite of forgiveness, and stressed for the house of Israel how heinous was sin in God's sight. There was thus a fundamental unity in all the leprosy laws. This is the law for all manner of plague of leprosy and scall, and for the leprosy of a garment and of a house, and for a rising and for a scab and for a bright spot, to teach when it is unclean and when it is clean. This is the law of leprosy. In all cases, it was a question of a defilement which was deeper than the skin in man and lower than the wall in houses. That is, of a defilement which had laid hold of the very tissue and fabric of man or house. In fact, of inbred sin and its corroding blight, to teach when it is unclean and when it is clean. This is the law of leprosy. Thus, in his bondage and in his cleansing alike, the leper represented Israel objectively to itself and educated the priestly people in the complete etiquette of acceptable worship of the covenant God. The law, while safeguarding the moral, mortal, physical life of man by imposing restrictions on the leper, contrived at the same time to tutor the nation also in the principles of spiritual hygiene. Well, may we ask, with Moses, what nation is there so great that hath statutes and judgments so righteous as all this law? The law of jealousies. To teach when it is unclean and when it is clean. True of the leprosy laws in particular, this may with justice be said to be the ulterior purpose of every other regulation which found its place beside them in the ritual of the law. Every mention of uncleanness or of cleanness was a veiled allusion to the absence or existence of covenant relationship to God and of the moral condition which was in each case presupposed. That relationship, its character, conditions and ethical demands may in fact be said to constitute the great overarching theme study of every subdivision of the law. To be God's and his alone, such was the purpose of Israel's election. I, the Lord, am holy and have severed you from other people that ye should be mine. To this fact, the law of the jealousy offering was designed to give the most solemn emphasis. The sacredness and inviolability of the covenant were symbolized in this instance by the mystic union of the marriage bond. By covenants, God and Israel had become one, as man and woman do in wedlock. Thus apostasy, being as shameful an act of infidelity on the spiritual plane as adultery upon the physical, came naturally to be alluded to as whoredom, with all that the term implied by way of those immoral acts which are the inevitable outcome of perverted worship. It was uncleanness in the widest sense of the term, both in its nature and in its consequences, and thus utterly incompatible with Israel's holy calling. Small wonder that the priests, types here again of the priestly people, were strictly forbidden to contract defiling marriages. The law was, they shall not take a wife that is a whore or profane. Neither shall they take a woman put away from her husband, for he is holy unto the Lord. What the priestly legislation thus taught, incidentally, the law of jealousies reiterated in intensified form, it conferred upon a husband who was suspicious of his wife's chastity, the right to extort from her, upon oath, a protestation of her innocence. If his suspicions were well founded, it meant that the woman had been guilty of going aside to uncleanness. Bearing in mind the twofold symbolic meaning which the law attached to the term uncleanness, how effectively we find the woman's act to have typified disloyalty by Israel to the covenant bond. and how properly too did the law denounce it as a trespass, that is, a deprivation of another's rights, and thereby intimate that such disloyalty was an act of robbery against God, who had declared, I have severed you from other people, that ye should be mine. It is precisely this which makes so luminous what otherwise would be a puzzling and discordant feature of the ritual enjoined in this case. Whereas the law conferred a right upon the husband, it made no mention of the same privilege for the woman. If not she, but her husband herself were the offending party. It can, of course, be argued that here, as elsewhere, the law accommodated itself to the social customs prevailing at the time of the Exodus. This is doubtless true, but it is wholly inadequate as an explanation of the discrepancy. Once we see in the wife, and in the wife only, a type of Israel, and so in her husband a type of God, all immediately becomes plain. It is at once obvious why the law could legislate for infidelity in the case only of the woman. Israel might fail, and did, but that God either could or would fail was utterly unthinkable, and the law designedly left no room for the veriest suspicion of it in the ritual. It in fact did the exact opposite, declaring the action of the husband in such cases to be an act of self-vindication and a desirable repudiation of any suggestion of connivance or indifference on his part. Then, said the law, shall the man be guiltless from iniquity, and this woman shall bear her iniquity. How effectively did this remind Israel that their divine husband, in order to be true to his essential holiness, would be compelled to visit judgment and cursing upon them should they be false to him. Yet, for all that, the purpose of the ritual was only to put the wife to the proof and not automatically to bring curse upon her. It could equally as often vindicate her innocence as expose her guilt. At the most, there was only a presumption of uncleanness, and special allowance was made for the fact that her husband's suspicions were as yet unsubstantiated, when therefore she was brought by him to the sanctuary to undergo the trial of jealousy. Her case was strictly sub judice, and the ritual took careful account of that fact, catering simultaneously for possibilities both of guilt and of innocence. If, as an outcome of the trial, she was shown to be actually guilty, no pardon would be available to her, but death would inevitably be her punishment. On the other hand, were she to be proved innocent, no pardon would be necessary, for there would be no sin to forgive. So the notion of expiation, this being either impossible or unnecessary on this occasion, was perforce excluded from the ritual. The woman's offering had therefore to be a cereal, that is, a bloodless offering. Allowance was next made for the fact that her ordeal, being both unsolicited and possibly unmerited, was a most humiliating experience and anything but an act of worship. In place of the normal cereal offering of fine flour, which in the circumstances would have been both incongruous and unbecoming, barley meal, the lowest variety of flour, was the meal prescribed for her. Yet her offering had of necessity to be brought into relation with the altar, since her purpose in coming to the sanctuary at her husband's behest was to protest her innocence before God, whose altar it was. Here, however, a complication arose in view of the circumstances attending its presentation. Still remained to be seen whether her protestation were sincere or an empty pretense, whether she were really innocent or guilty. Now, therefore, the normal adjuncts of meal offering, namely oil and frankincense, the one symbolizing the origin of her works in God and the other their acceptability to him, were forbidden in this exceptional case. It is an offering of jealousy, an offering of memorial, of bringing iniquity to remembrance. Awesome indeed must have been the woman's trial. In an earthen vessel, the priest placed holy water, drawn doubtless from the laver, fortified with an admixture of dust from the floor of the tabernacle, the sacred abode of God most holy, as she stood before him with uncovered head, in token of her humiliation, with her offering in her hands, the priest holding the earthen vessel in his own hands, called on her to swear on oath that she was innocent, and to give assent with twofold amen to the curses which would punish perjury. The priest then recorded these curses in a book and symbolically washed them into the water, which became bitter as a result. Bitter, of course, not in taste, but in its associations and potential power for harm. Finally, taking the woman's offering and in conformity with her protestation of innocence, first waving it as a consecrated thing before God, the priest burnt the usual memorial, or as Kara, on the altar. The woman had then forthwith to complete the ceremony by drinking the contents of the earthen vessel, fearing no other effect if truly innocent, but incurring inevitable curse. If actually guilty, that curse would become operative in a distressing disease causing barrenness, and visible bodily changes as outward symptoms of it in cases of guilt. The water itself possessing not some magical potency, but only a symbolic, injurious power. There's a footnote here to mention regarding these visible bodily changes, that the absence of them would preserve other barren women from the suspicion of unchastity. Rightfully, the law added, if the woman be not defiled, but be clean, then she shall be free and shall conceive seed. Not defiled, but clean. How effectively these few words drew the meaning of the ritual to the attention of those whose standing before God had its fixed symbolical expression in animals of the category clean. That meaning was patent for all with eyes to see. The death penalty visited upon proven adultery warned Israel strikingly against overt apostasy, but no less necessary was a warning against secret, inward longing after other gods. Thus it fell to the law of jealousies to administer reminding Israel of the perils of disloyalty to the covenant by indicating that even if practiced in the silence of their hearts, such disloyalty would not escape the notice of the omniscient God, who was their Lord. Moses, in evident allusion to the law of Genesis, bade Israel, "Beware lest there be among you a root that beareth gall and wormwood, that would lead them to neglect the covenant with God in favor of another," i.e., that is, to turn aside unto uncleanness, like the unchaste wife. Curses of sickness and barrenness would result from such infidelity, and they would be uprooted from their land. The apostle merely borrowed his imagery from both the ritual of the jealousy offering and the comments of Moses upon it, when he warned the would-be apostates of his own day to look diligently, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many be defiled, lest there be any fornicator or profane person as Esau. His words are a reminder to us today that the moral principles of the old covenant have carried over into the new covenant.